Fetty coming back 3-2. Here's a high fly ball, deep right field. This ball's got a chance. Gone! Michael Bush. Cubs lead 5-0.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
Hour number two, Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score. The Cubs have spent the last couple of days operating on each end of that victorious spectrum. Last night's game against the Redbirds took a while for that offense to get going. Took all the way to the ninth inning. Then it came alive and had their first multi-run comeback in the ninth inning of the entire season. That was a lot of fun. Then today, offense really clicked early. 5 runs through the first couple of innings. 5-0 lead. Then they made things really, really interesting. A lot more interesting than I'm sure Craig Counsell wanted them to be down the stretch. But in the end, they got out of some jams and came out with the 6-3 lead over the division rival Cardinals. Let's go out to the hotline, though, and continue some conversation about those Cubs, about baseball, and do so on the Score Hotline presented by Circus Sports Illinois. Talk to Tony Andracki of the Marquee Sports Network. You can find him on social at TonyAndracki23. What's happening, Tony? How you doing this evening?
Hey, I'm doing great. How are you?
Spectacular. And I'm a little bit pensive. I'm a little bit indecisive at how to view this Cubs squad right now because I feel like we've been had before when they started to play some quality baseball, started to stack a few victories going into the All-Star break. And it's like, all right, are they good now? Are we invested now? Are the Cubs invested? Are we emotionally invested? Are we believers yet? And then it comes a crashing down. So 3-game win streak going. Where you at with this thing, Tony? Are the Cubs good?
That's a great question. Maybe, maybe not. I think we'll have to see. You know, so often this year, exactly like what you were describing, we've seen it play out that they've had momentum and, you know, they've certainly had good stretches. I think the best stretch of the season since April was, you know, that series where they stood out the Orioles and they had a 4 or 5 game winning streak, whatever that was that they put together. That was a really strong stretch. And then obviously things changed a bit, mostly because they went into the All-Star break and really struggled coming out of it. But yeah, we've seen like these teases basically of good momentum coming, and they haven't been able to carry it over for more than a couple of days at a time. And will they this time? I don't know. Does it feel a little different right now? Like, yeah, it does. And it always kind of does until something else changes. You know, after that 5-run second inning, they only scored once, and they scored because of an error where Seiya actually got picked off second base. And then as he was started to run back, you know, the Cardinals reliever, I can't remember who it was at the time, ended up throwing the ball in center field, and Seiya comes around to score. But other than that, you know, PCA walks, steals second to lead off an inning, and they can't get him home. So they really just had one big inning today. Yesterday, they kind of just had the one big inning as well. 12, 13 runs, whatever it was the other night too. So the offense, I think there's still a little bit of meat left on the bone, and they got to figure that out and settle that in before I can really say that, like, yeah, they're back. And also, I think it's always like getting to 500. When you're still 4 under .500, you feel good for sure, but you know the likelihood of them making the playoffs is still so low. It's like less than 10% still. So I think, you know, you're at the point of like, let's see this for a little bit longer period of time, but it certainly has been a fun week.
There's a few different aspects of where the team has struggled and they're now showing signs of turning a corner that really intrigue me. There's the bullpen really pitching at a high level all throughout July. There's the lack of late game execution that we finally got an example of that last night. And there's the enhanced power. So I want to start with the enhanced power that we've begun to see with extra base hits. I mean, they've been one of the better teams. They led the National League in doubles throughout the month of July. We've seen some increased pop, especially as the lineup has gotten a bit healthy here as of late. Bellinger coming back and Rankin and Dansby Swanson finally starting to swing a stronger stick here. Is there something that you would point toward to see that now this lineup has really had, you know, some more enhanced pop than what we saw earlier in the season?
Yeah, I think it's what you said. It's the Bellinger aspect. last year it was right around this time and a little bit before where Bellinger was like on this unreal run. And that was part of what led to the Cubs run was because it was like seemingly every night he had a big two run double or two out homer or something like that. And he was giving the Cubs leads early, like first inning, second inning, pretty consistently throughout a month and a half or a 2 month stretch. And then when he kind of started fading a little bit, then it was Seiya that was picking it up. But, you know, ultimately, like, as we know, the Cubs finished one game short of the playoffs last year. But I do think Bellinger coming back for 2 months prior to going on the IL, he only had two homers total. He had two in the first three games coming back while still with a broken finger that's affected him to the point where he can't even throw. It's on his throwing hand. So he's just been DHing. He's wearing this little like pad that when he's hitting at the plate too, and yet still comes back and, you know, hits a double and two home runs in the first three games and has eight hits total in the first four games now. So I think it's him is the big thing that I kind of point to with power. And I think Dansby Swanson as well, his power maybe necessarily hasn't quite been there, but he's looked really good the last 2 weeks or so, the last, I think, 15, 16 games. You know, he's hitting over 300, I believe. He's getting on base at like a 380 clip. And I think those two guys getting back is really helpful. And then the whole reason they acquired Isak Paredes is because he's more consistent and that they hope that a guy like him will not have quite the highs and lows that Christopher Morel had. You know, put the ball in play more. Maybe that would help with runners in scoring position and stuff. You know, fewer strikeouts, fewer swing and miss, roughly the same amount of power. And we kind of even saw that today. He struck out, but in that second inning before the five-run rally, he wore down Fetty with a 12-pitch at-bat and eight straight foul balls. So I think Paredes is one of those guys who does a lot of little things well that can help the team.
All right. On to the bullpen. That was such a cause for concern with as dominant as the starting staff had been through the first couple of months of the season. The bullpen was struggling and was beat up, you know, to be fair. And now, throughout the month of July, I mean, saw the stat. You know, I'm sure you probably were the one who gave the stat on the Marquee Sports Network today. Lowest bullpen ERA since June 27th, man, a 1.38 bullpen ERA throughout July and into today's game. I mean, where did this come from?
Yeah, it's a great question. And, yeah, like you said, I mean, that 1.38 is awesome, but it's also a run lower than the next closest, the Braves at 2.4. So it's pretty incredible overall, but I think this is what Council was brought in for, and it took a while for sure, like you were saying, but they definitely have righted the ship in the bullpen, and there's a lot of guys to give credit for that. Hector Neris had some struggles. I think it was like early June were some of his bigger struggles, and he's been pretty darn good since then, and Drew Smyly's been phenomenal, actually. Tyson Miller continues to fly under the radar. Porter Hodge, the young kid that came up earlier this year, and even Craig Council had acknowledged that it's probably a bit early for him in his development, but yet he's proven that he can get big league hitters out. He can, you know, he's thrown a lot more strikes and they've been really impressed with him. He's pitching in high leverage moments. Then you factor in like Julian Merriweather's coming back, and Nate Pearson had two big innings out of the bullpen yesterday, the trade deadline acquisition. Jorge Lopez, you know, after falling out with the Mets, has pitched pretty well for the Cubs. So I think they've just mixed and matched really well, and they found good pockets of the order to put guys out there, and they're just getting outs. You know, that's all it comes down to. There's not a ton of swing and miss or super high strikeout numbers and everything else, but, you know, I do think that there's enough guys down there that they can withstand the loss of a guy like Mark Leiter Jr.
And then finally, the late-game dramatics, which, you know, we've seen shirts ripped off late in game from the Cubs and some walk-off moments in recent seasons here, but up until last night, they were 0 for 38 in opportunities to make a ninth-inning comeback of two runs or more. And last night, they finally got that. Today, they didn't need to pull that off because they got out to a big lead today against St. Louis and held on to it. But in the ninth inning, with this offense and the way the offense has struggled, there hasn't been that ability to come up with big hits in key moments. So last night, we can be hopeful that maybe that's a turning of the corner. But is there anything you would point to that's a familiar refrain, something that's a consistency with some of the struggles to really get the offense going, I guess really all throughout the game, but especially in the ninth inning, because they've played so many close games where they've still been in it in the ninth but haven't been able to come up with those critical hits?
Yeah, for sure. And I think they've had games where they've been down two or three runs and going in the ninth, and then they'll score one or two and come really close, or they'll be, right. They'll have the tying run on second and third or something. You know, how many times has that happened this year too? So yeah, last night definitely was a great moment just overall. I was telling my colleague Andy Martinez today that it was one of the more fun games that I've covered throughout my career. It was, so improbable, and the fact that Ryan Helsley is an all-star closer, had only blown two saves all year. He'd never given up a single extra base hit with two strikes this year, and the Cubs had three two-strike extra base hits in that inning, which is an incredible stat. They were down, both Dansby and Talkman were down 0-2, battled back to get the big hits. So it was a really cool win, and those are the type of wins that certainly can help build momentum and, to your point, can help you give you a confidence and help you feel like, okay, we're going to the ninth inning. Doesn't matter if it's one of the best closers in the game or maybe arguably the best closer in the game out there, a guy that throws 100 with a 92-mile-an-hour slider. Doesn't matter. We can go out there, have good at-bats, and come back. And so, yeah, I think when you get a win like that, that is so improbable. It was like 4% chance they had of winning that game going into the ninth inning before Bellinger's homer. And to pull that out, it can carry over. And I do think that there is a possible momentum shift in the offense, but like we were talking about at the start, you really have to go out there and do it on a consistent day-to-day basis as well. But yeah, I think it was a little bit of a culmination of some of those like fake rallies or whatever you want to call them, like the almost rallies that they've had in the ninth, where they were actually like able to pull through and not only tie the game, but take the lead. And we'll see if they're able to put together a couple more of those.
Tony Andracki is the digital content manager and Cubs reporter for the Marquee Sports Network. He is on social at TonyAndracki23. He's also my guest on The Score. The trade deadline and the activity or lack thereof, I guess, at the trade deadline, it was a difficult position because there's not a lot of guys who would be really sort of renowned for other ball clubs and who teams would be hopeful to bring in, that it would be easy for the Cubs to unload. So in some ways, they kind of stood pat. There was no big unloading of talent. There was no big acquisition of talent as well. They sort of just kind of straddled the line a little bit. What do you make of the trade deadline transactions from Jed, and how do you think they view the roster as it sits right now?
Yeah, I thought just overall the trade deadline I thought was super intriguing. That's the word that keeps coming, popping into my head about what the Cubs did at this deadline, because so many people want to, it's so black and white, like, are you a seller, are you a buyer? And there is a middle ground, there's a gray area, and that's where Jed and Carter basically lived at this deadline, because they got rid of Morel, but they got Paredes back. And, they acquired Nate Pearson, who I think is really interesting, former top prospect. But they also gave up a reliever and Leiter. So, they in some ways like netted out about equal. But I do think what they set themselves up really, really well for the final couple months of this year, but also next year and beyond. And Jack Neely, the reliever they got from the Yankees for Leiter, is a big 6'8 guy, can throw in the mid to upper 90s. Pretty good slider so far from what we've seen in the minors. And he's in AAA now. So if he does come up and perform well and it can be a part of the bullpen, then you have a guy who's under team control for the next 6 years in return for Leiter, who's under team control for the next couple. So I think that makes a lot of sense too. And then, yeah, like Paredes so far, I mean, he has, I think, 9-something war over the last couple of years. In the same time, Morel has 2-something. So the defense matters, the consistency at the plate matters. And I think overall, it was just really, really interesting. What it means for the rest of this year, I'm not quite sure. I think that it has set themselves up to potentially make a run. As we said, it's like a 7-8% chance right now that they make the playoffs. But still, crazier things have happened. And then for next year, I think they're set up better, especially if a guy like Pearson, if the change of scenery helps, he could figure it out. He has incredible stuff. And a former like top 10 prospect in the game with the Blue Jays before they traded him away here. So I'm intrigued. I'm really curious to see what these guys can be in the future. And I think to give up Morel, who essentially didn't have a position, and then a guy like Leiter, who's 32, 33, and only under team control for a couple of years, I think there were ultimately good moves here.
And with the focus on setting this ball club up for 2025 and beyond, part of what will go into that equation is how things finish up for this season. So there's some signs that perhaps there's some ascension that could be beginning with the performance of the squad. Are there many recent examples in baseball of a strong finish for a squad that didn't win a championship, perhaps didn't even sniff a championship in 1 year? I can think of multiple football examples where a strong, you know, Detroit Lions are just a recent example from the year before last, where they finished strong in 1 year and then going to run to the NFC title game. The Jacksonville Jaguars a couple years ago finished strong in a previous season with a young quarterback, and here come the Jags the following year making the playoffs, winning a playoff game. Does that tend to happen frequently in baseball? This is a season that doesn't really have championship aspirations for the Cubs, but what does a strong finish to this year really equate to for next season?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. There's no example that comes to mind that I can think of, like the Lions that you mentioned a couple years ago, you know, when they beat the Packers in the final day of the regular season. Like, nothing like that quite comes to mind that I think of for baseball, but I do think the final 2 months are super important for this team, whether they sniff the playoffs or not, because there's some pressure for sure, I think, on Hoyer's front office and stuff of, like, yeah, it's been a few years now without playoffs, and assuming they don't make it this year, then do they go all in, or how aggressive are they in the offseason to try to make it in 2025? And I think there's only so many moves you can make, assuming a guy like Bellinger kind of opts in, and so many guys are under team control for next year as well. So I think, but also, you know, you could get aggressive with trades. Like, the Morel for Paredes thing was not really on pretty much anybody's radar at the trade deadline here, and the team swapped third baseman. So I think there's a lot of options for the Cubs, but the final 2 months are big because you need to establish that winning culture. You need to feel good and confident going in. And what Jed has said as well is it's not just the wins, but it's the offense. They came into this year after having the third most runs scored in the NL last year, sixth most in baseball. They thought their offense was great. They added Michael Busch, who's a strong rookie of the year candidate, to that mix, basically brought everybody else back, including Bellinger, you know, add PCA to it. Like, they thought that they had a good group here, and it just hasn't played out that way. And so I think they need to feel really good about the offense going into the offseason to then come into next year with a different level of confidence and belief in this group can go out and perform basically unlike they did in May and June when they really, really struggled. I mean, they were the worst offense in baseball for 2 months straight, basically, and that's the reason why they are where they are in the standings. So I think that's as big as anything. And then I would say, too, for some of these young pitchers and young players, like, let's see how Busch and PCA go through a full big league season. And even guys like Javier Assad or Shota. Shota's, you know, 30, almost 31 years old, but he's never gone through a full big league season like this, too. So see how he holds up there. And then guys like Ben Brown and Jordan Wicks and Hayden Wesneski, they're all in the aisle now, but the Cubs expect them to pitch again this year. So when they come back from injury, how they perform, what role they're in, how they continue to develop, I think these are all really big things to continue to watch. And then also, I'm just curious if guys like Shota and Busch are, you know, end up winning the NL Rookie of the Year, because I think that'll be a really cool race to watch down the stretch.
I feel pretty comfortable calling Shota Imanaga Showtime Imanaga, and I'm not completely clear on PCA. I haven't workshopped it much yet, but I feel like Pete Crow's swag strong is something that could get some run, that could get a little bit of play at some point here just with his demeanor out there on the field. When you look at PCA, and it seems like there's been a lot more hard hitting that's been going on there, even with some bad luck, with things not dropping in for him. And, of course, the base paths, that speed has been on display, and they have yet to throw him out at the major league level. How have you seen his development? What are your observations of what we've seen from PCA?
Yeah, to me, the last, like, week and a half looks like a totally different hitter than we saw for this first few months of this season that he was in the big leagues. Like, this is a guy who's hardly chasing at all. I think there were so many times where he was just swinging at pitches out of the zone. There's so many at-bats where he almost just looked overmatched at times earlier in the season, and that just doesn't seem to be happening at all right now. And so many of the outs he's had over the last 7 to 10 days are hard lineouts or hard ground balls or balls that he hits pretty well that are right at guys, and or just put good swings on it in general and swung at the right pitch, made good swing decisions. Even today, you know, he got to, I think it was a 3-0, 3-1 count, whatever it was a 3-1 pitch that he was able to hammer a hit into right field and get the Cubs on the board in that second inning. And then he worked a really good walk later in the game as well. You know, steals second, 21 straight stolen bases for him as well this year without being caught, which is kind of cool. So, yeah, I see a guy who's just all of a sudden shown like immense growth at the plate and could just be a good stretch. I think, you know, the league adjusting back to him, he'll have to continue to make adjustments. And as I said, too, make sure that, you know, he's not wearing down over the course of a full big league season and stuff as well. But I think there's a lot of promising, encouraging signs from PCA, just especially in the last week or so. And that should have been something I mentioned as well in terms of down the stretch. Like, that's a huge, huge thing to watch because this is a guy who can be a star, I think, for years to come here. And he was there was a reason why he was a consensus number one prospect in the system. And I think he's starting to show that a little bit.
Man, that would mean so much to the Cubs. That position with that athleticism, if he does add some consistency in the box, then yes, having PCA playing at a high level and having him, you know, show the ability to extend that, to be consistent with it, would mean a lot for the Cubs. Or go the route of Christopher Morel and maybe he'll be gone sometime middle of next season if that development doesn't end up showing. I guess it could go either two ways, Tony, but we know you will cover it well and you'll keep everyone informed on it. As always, appreciate your time, man.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for having me, man.
That is Tony Andracki of the Marquee Sports Network. You can find him on social at TonyAndracki23. Well, let's get back to some of the Hall of Fame conversation and give you the chance to hear from some of these Hall of Famers because Molly and Haw have been in Canton for the last couple of days. They're going to continue the weekend out there. And they have talked to, it seems like, every luminary who is in and around the Pro Football Hall of Fame. Molly and Haw have had an opportunity to talk to them. So you're going to hear from some of the folks who not only are going to the Hall, but who have been surrounding this event as well. We'll get to some of that sound for you next on Chicago Sports Radio, 670 The Score.
You know what? ALS is more prevalent than you would imagine because now that I'm so aware of it and people know that what I'm dealing with, I get it all the time. People, you know, say, oh, my sister had it, my husband had it, my brother had it. Like, I hear it all the time now. So I think it is becoming more aware, and I think we're already doing that by talking about it and getting it out there. So, yeah, it's more prevalent than you would imagine.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
The voice of Mr. McMichael, the wife of Steve Mongo McMichael, as he will be enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame tomorrow. It's one of the callers we had on earlier in the show, in the first hour, just talking about the disappointment with Hall of Famers, both in football and in baseball, not getting an opportunity while they're still at their physical best to really take it in, to appreciate it, to participate in it. And I get that. I understand that frustration. While at the same time, I do believe there is a balancing act for the selection committee, the selection process, with how you go about factoring that in. Because in the end, there are criteria that end up, you know, needing to be met. It's a subjective criteria, but do you put someone into the Hall of Fame? You know, do you add people to the list, you know, because you know that they're getting older, because there's health concerns? That's why they do end up having the, you know, multiple areas of Hall of Fame selection for some of the all-time greats who maybe didn't get in the modern era. Then, you know, you do get the opportunity to perhaps make it in amongst the peers for, you know, some of the guys who are a little bit older and didn't make it in the initial portion of the process as well. But Steve McMichael, you know, it's a part of what, you know, Alex Hoon played the clip a little bit early with Misty talking about just feeling like it's given them more time together. So as much as there can be some disappointment, maybe even a tinge of anger for some folks about it taking as long as it has for one of the greatest players in pro football history. But in the end, you would hope that there's a lot of the joy that can be felt for the honor finally coming for Steve McMichael as well. It's certainly the spin I try to sort of view it through, the lens I try to look at this opportunity through as it relates to Mongo. And let's flip the order of what we had discussed, Alex, because the, you know, just kind of continuing the conversation about Steve McMichael, his wife Misty being there. And it was great that Mully and Haw, our morning show here at The Score, has been in Canton for a couple of days now, and they've been able to talk to a bunch of folks about this process, about what it means to be in Canton. A lot of the luminaries that are there in town, and Misty McMichael was good enough to join Mully and Haw on the air a bit earlier. And, you know, let's hear some of the sound from what they were able to discuss with Misty. One of the other things was to that exact point. She spoke to Mully and Haw about the fact that she does feel like this, about knowing that he's getting ready to be enshrined in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, has given her more time with her husband.
I heard you say that you feel like it's bought you more time with him. That's just a beautiful sentence.
It has, because, you know, we had a DNR before this this year's class induction, and I knew that when they were down from 100 to 12, I knew that we were going to get in. And that's when we ripped up the do not resuscitate and told him, babe, you're going to have to stick it in, you know, stick it out and see yourself get into the hall. And he has. And now he doesn't want to, he wants to live, you know, even past this. So this has given us a lot more time, and I totally appreciate it.
And, you know, I understand where there would be, you know, sort of negative feelings about the idea that, you know, something that can be such an honor for someone whose health is failing in the way that Steve McMichael's health has been failing here, then the idea, well, you know, why would they wait? Why didn't this come sooner? His acclaim on the field, his game on the field has earned that right. It's one of the things we'll be able to talk to Howard Balzer about a bit later in the show as well, because he is involved in that process, and it's a monumental undertaking. I've been able to speak to Dan Pompey about it, and like I mentioned, Howard Balzer will join us later in the show. There are so many different things to factor into this subjective process, and they're only allowed to put so many in on an annual basis. But there was some discussion, because this honor was now finally here for Mongo. There was some discussion about whether or not it would make sense. And Misty and Steve, initially, they were planning on him being there in Canton. The NFL apparently stepped in and decided it wasn't going to be an idea of something that they felt as comfortable with being able to support them in the way that was necessary. And so Misty discussed with Mully and Haw the idea of potentially bringing Steve to Canton.
For Steve, yes. Yeah. I had an ICU jet donated and everything, but when I spoke with the president, Jim Porter, you know, we just couldn't guarantee his medically being sustained here.
Yes.
So, you know, no one was really big on him dying here.
Right.
So, and neither was he. So we regrouped, and, you know, we're going to take a private jet to him. So I think that's better. He can't even get out of bed now. You know, it's so bad. So it's just best for him.
And, you know, for any of you, and I know there's many of you out there who've watched a loved one and watched their health fail, watched their health fade, watched them become, you know, weakened and thin and things like that. And I've, you know, unfortunately had to be in that position multiple times here in recent years of my life with people who are very close to me. And it can be a really difficult thing to watch that part play out. And I understand the point of view of whether or not, I've been able to discuss this with a few different people in recent weeks as some of this news has churned here about whether or not Steve McMichael would go to Canton and the idea that maybe he should be in Canton. I think in a perfect world, yes, it would make all the sense for him to be able to be there around the ceremony itself and take that in and to even more directly feel the love and the admiration of those who were there in the house at Tom Benson Hall of Fame Stadium. But there's a great risk that would come with that. So I understand the balancing act of putting his fading health at enhanced risk, at additional risk for him to be there in person. They decided to go a different direction with it. And that's actually one of the things that Misty discussed with the guys as well, with Mully and Haw, about bringing Steve's teammates and being able to join him for his ceremony that's still going to take place.
Gary Finsick will be there, Bruce Herron, Jim Osborne, Jay Hilgenberg, Tommy Thayer. Yeah, all the guys, Matsui, all the guys that aren't here will be there, and I'll have the other half here.
And I think that's marvelous. You know, it's not the perfect scenario, but I think it is making the best of the scenario that's available to them right now. and 312-644-6767. It's the number. You can go ahead and give me a call, and we're going to keep the Hall of Fame discussion rolling here about Steve McMichael, about Devin Hester, about Julius Peppers. 312-644-6767. And the resume, the Hall of Fame career, Steve McMichael, you know, came in with the New England Patriots in 1980, spent 13 seasons with the Bears, finished up his career with the Packers in 1994. And after being selected in the third round by the Patriots, they came out of the University of Texas, signed with the Bears in 81 after the Patriots let him go. I'm assuming if the Patriots knew they were letting go of a Hall of Famer, they would have went ahead and stuck it out with Mongo. But he ended up starting a franchise record 191 consecutive games over those 13 seasons with the Bears and finished his career with the most tackles and most sacks in Bears history, those 92 and a half sacks that he had with the Bears. Twice led the Bears in sacks in 88 and 92. And those defenses that he was a part of allowed the fewest points, fewest rushing yards, fewest total yards in the NFL from 1982 to 1981. So for a decade, the Bears had the best defense in football and played in 14 career playoff games with 11 starts. Of course, part of that 85 Bears squad, one of the greatest teams of all time in Super Bowl 20, and they beat his former squad, the Patriots, in Super Bowl 20. And he was a starter in that game, had a sack amongst that dominant performance from the Bears D. Earned first-team All-Pro three times in his career, 85, 86, and 87. Had a couple of Pro Bowl nods in addition to that in 88 and 89 as well. So the production is astounding. And playing a position, the way he played it, with that production, with the physicality, and to maintain the energy that he did, was one of the more astounding things about Steve McMichael, especially for that era, playing in the 80s and into the early 90s, where being a defensive tackle, being an interior defensive lineman, the amount of double teams, the amount of physicality, the percentage of the run game that was such a huge part of the NFL during that era, and just for him to still be able to chase the ball all over the field and have the wherewithal to get off those blocks, get into the backfield, get to the quarterback during that era, he was certainly ahead of his time with that combination of energy, of the willingness to hit blocks, of the production that he had in the backfield with the quarterback and the running back tackles for losses. He certainly is truly one of the greatest players to ever do it. So looking forward to seeing Misty McMichael on the stage. Looking forward to watching Mongo get inducted into the Hall as well. When we come back, we hear from Devin Hester as well. He was also on with Mully and Hall. He was able to join the guys. And also, before I get out of here tonight, I'm going to share some of the stories, because this is such a, you know, I mentioned it being a monumental undertaking for the selection committee and the process that they go through. But part of the reason that there's this gravity that's felt by it is because many of them have gotten to be around these players, these sort of, you know, these figures that have been placed on these pedestals because of the popularity of the sport and the difficulty of the sport that they participate in. And everyone knows that football has for decades now been the most popular sport in this country, and it's far and away continued in that regard. So the guys who are the greatest to ever do it and to be recognized with the gold jacket, it means so much to them, means so much to their friends, their family, and these fan bases. So we'll continue that conversation as well. 312-644-6767. I know a lot of you have strong opinions. We already had some callers on earlier in the show talking about their thoughts, not only on Mongo, but Devin Hester, Julius Peppers going in to the Pro Football Hall of Fame representing the Chicago Bears. You will hear from the ridiculous one himself as he was on with Mully and Hall. We'll get the Devin Hester sound coming next on The Score.
I would say my favorite term would probably have to be, I have two really, I can say it. Probably the Arizona Cardinals, and then of course the Super Bowl.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
When you run the opening kick of the Super Bowl back, it's a big deal. No doubt about that, man. I remember not only just watching that game play out, being a Chicagoan and having friends on both squads, including the Indianapolis Colts, but the way that game started out and how Devin Hester was just, you know, just seemingly just shot out of a cannon to open things up, and he gets into the open field. You know, no one is going to catch him. It was a pretty special, very magical sort of moment for the Bears' return specialist. And you know, at that point, we didn't know what he was going to be, didn't know if his career was on any kind of Hall of Fame trajectory. We just knew he was this young, exciting player on a team that had a city that was starved for another championship from the Bears, and it was a team with a defense that was certainly worthy of it, special teams that was no doubt worthy of it, an offense that had its fits and starts, but up against the juggernaut that was the Indianapolis Colts and Peyton Manning trying to get his first Super Bowl championship. But to open up like that, anything seemed possible at that moment. There's no doubt. And for Devin Hester, you know, he's been able to now soak this in because there's not a lot of players. Like Billy White Shoes Johnson, I've gotten to know him pretty well over the years. He was a player that made a bunch of plays, not only as a playmaking wide receiver, but as a returner as well. And, you know, had a celebration, you know, that folks got to know really well. Also, he's the type of player that it feels like, you know what, if there was more, I guess, respect or deference, more value placed on some of these guys who put the ball in the end zone as returners, then Billy White Shoes Johnson would be a guy who'd be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and he hasn't been able to get in. And I know it's a source of disappointment for him because he does feel like the career that he put together was worthy of that call to the Hall, and he hasn't gotten that recognition up to this point in his life. But Devin Hester finally has. It wasn't on the first ballot, but he didn't have to wait nearly as long as a lot of other folks historically have had to wait when it's been apparent that they've been amongst the all-time greats. And Devin Hester, known as one of the all-time greats, and especially in this era of sports media coverage, then there did seem to be a good amount of momentum that had built for Devin Hester to be a player who folks felt like should and eventually would get into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And he was nice enough to bless the stage with Mully and Haw earlier this morning and talk about the honor that's now been bestowed upon him. And one of the things, because you know, Mully and Haw have had the conversation for a couple of days now about watching his development, not only the development of his game, but just the development of his presence, you know, his demeanor publicly. He was a guy who was in the media a lot where folks wanted to talk to him, folks wanted to be around him, and he had this calm, understated personality. And then a lot of that calm went away when he got the football in his hands. But it's one thing that they spoke to Devin Hester about was just how far he came since, you know, entering the NFL as this very meek, mild, and quiet rookie with the Chicago Bears.
Yeah, it was a whirlwind for me, you know, just more so of the first 2 years, people didn't believe I could do what I do. And the following 4 or 5 years from now, people respected me. So whenever I was out there on the field, they feared me. So it limited the returns that I had. So that played a big toll in my career, I would say, you know, just with the new rule nowadays, I probably would have had over 40 returns.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree. When you think about it, we got a chance to look at the new kickoff rules last night. And the way that the league has tried to, like the term that Richard Hightower has used a bunch in the media, Bears special teams coordinator, but talking about keeping the foot in the game. And as safety has become this big focal point for rules adjustments in the NFL, safety of quarterbacks in the pocket, safety of receivers coming across the middle, safety of players on special teams running full speed, screaming down the field, dozens and dozens of yards and going 20 plus miles an hour and crashing into each other at these high velocities, then yes, your brain is going to be rattled in an enhanced way. Orthopedically, your joints are going to take more of the brunt of those impacts. And so they've made some adjustments, and they took advantage of the opportunity to talk to Devin Hester, especially after getting to watch it live and in person last night, on the new kickoff rules, because the foot, at least at the moment, it does appear is going to stay in the game.
I feel like the new rule is really going to force the return game, bring it back to life. And so it's a way to bring back special team. It's a way to bring back the returners that kind of got shadowed and overlooked because of the new rule. Of course, y'all know the rule was put in because of me. So
that's right.
Now it allows return to get their hands on the ball. So I'm hoping that we can bring back this return game, which was a big exciting part of the game.
And I got to say, my initial impressions after watching it play out last night, I'm still not certain what to make of it. I don't know if teams will, you know, like the Bears having Velus Jones, having access to him, who has showed talents as a returner, both at the collegiate level and at the professional level, as a kick returner more so than a punt returner in both phases, but certainly in the NFL here. But What do the Bears do with a player like Velus Jones? Is that enough? I mean, we saw what Cordarrelle Patterson, the career that he's been able to put together without necessarily being a big or a consistent weapon offensively. Certainly as a running back after moving from wide receiver, he's had some of his best seasons when folks just turn and hand him the ball or toss him the ball. There's been a role that's been found for Cordarrelle Patterson on offense during his career, but certainly being considered a great player, it's as a returner. He's been a great return specialist throughout his career and potentially of Hall of Fame caliber when you look at the numbers that he's been able to put together here. There's only going to be so many of those who have that opportunity. So I do wonder, what's that going to look like moving forward? What brand of player will be utilized there? You know, we saw the contract that DJ Moore just got from the Bears. Would they be willing to utilize a player like DJ Moore, who's a big-time wide receiver, but in this scenario now with the new rule, how will that end up being viewed, not only initially where everybody's just kind of waiting to see what plays out, but as you get through games of this season, as if the rule stays at least in some form or fashion of what it is right now, where the blockers and the cover people are only 5 yards apart, then do teams just start to treat this as a scrimmage play? Do they just start to treat this almost like an opportunity just between the white lines, so just a regular offensive snap? And if you do you get the opportunity to utilize running backs, receivers, players who are some of your best playmakers with the football in their hands? And in the past, this would have been viewed as putting your best players at risk if you run them out there as returners on special teams. But do you see some teams start to utilize some of these playmakers in that way? Does Derrick Henry, who was an amazing kick returner in high school because of his size and speed, does Derrick Henry return kicks in the NFL? Because this is like taking a toss play, you know, for a guy like Derrick Henry. I'm really curious what that ends up looking like. And so regardless of it, the Devin Hester archetype, we've very likely seen the last of that, because while the foot is staying in the game, the return game is still going to be a big part of how things operate moving forward. It's going to look very different. We got to look at that last night, as did Devin Hester. We'll continue the conversation about all these Hall of Famers and what's to come for them tomorrow. Also going to share some stories about what I ended up experiencing, because the Hall of Fame and the importance of it that players and fans end up placing on it. I want to talk through some of that with some of the conversations that I've had specifically with some of the guys who've been through this and have experienced what it's like. And especially because, you know, there have been some opportunities for me to cover these guys, not only interviewing them on the air, but to have some conversations with them off camera and what this has been like for them. We're going to address that and kind of get into that with you. And feel free to give me a call at 312-644-6767, 312-644-6767. Among some of the all-time greats who are on their way to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, three players who have represented the Chicago Bears very well amongst that crew. We're keeping that conversation rolling as we preview the Pro Football Hall of Fame enshrinement. We'll keep that going in that final hour coming up on The Score.
I would say my favorite term would probably have to be, I have two really, I can say it. Probably the Arizona Cardinals, and then of course the Super Bowl.
We're back live with more Anthony Herron on 670 The Score in Odyssey Station.
When you run the opening kick of the Super Bowl back, it's a big deal. No doubt about that, man. I remember not only just watching that game play out, being a Chicagoan and having friends on both squads, including the Indianapolis Colts, but the way that game started out and how Devin Hester was just, you know, just seemingly just shot out of a cannon to open things up, and he gets into the open field. You know, no one is going to catch him. It was a pretty special, very magical sort of moment for the Bears return specialist. And you know, at that point, we didn't know what he was going to be, didn't know if his career was on any kind of Hall of Fame trajectory. We just knew he was this young, exciting player on a team that had a city that was starved for another championship from the Bears. And it was a team with a defense that was certainly worthy of it, special teams that was no doubt worthy of it, an offense that had its fits and starts, but up against the juggernaut that was the Indianapolis Colts and Peyton Manning trying to get his first Super Bowl championship. But to open up like that, anything seemed possible at that moment. There's no doubt. And for Devin Hester, you know, he's been able to now soak this in because there's not a lot of players. Like Billy White Shoes Johnson, I've gotten to know him pretty well over the years. He was a player that made a bunch of plays, not only as a playmaking wide receiver, but as a returner as well. And, you know, had a celebration, you know, that folks got to know really well. Also, he's the type of player that it feels like, you know what, if there was more, I guess, respect or deference, more value placed on some of these guys who put the ball in the end zone as returners, then Billy White Shoes Johnson would be a guy who'd be in the Pro Football Hall of Fame, and he hasn't been able to get in. And I know it's a source of disappointment for him because he does feel like the career that he put together was worthy of that call to the Hall, and he hasn't gotten that recognition up to this point in his life. But Devin Hester finally has. It wasn't on the first ballot, but he didn't have to wait nearly as long as a lot of other folks historically have had to wait when it's been apparent that they've been amongst the all-time greats. And Devin Hester, known as one of the all-time greats, and especially in this era of sports media coverage, then there did seem to be a good amount of momentum that had built for Devin Hester to be a player who folks felt like should and eventually would get into the Pro Football Hall of Fame. And he was nice enough to bless the stage with Mully and Haw earlier this morning and talk about the honor that's now been bestowed upon him. And one of the things, because you know, Mully and Haw have had the conversation for a couple of days now about watching his development, not only the development of his game, but just the development of his presence, you know, his demeanor publicly. He was a guy who was in the media a lot where folks wanted to talk to him, folks wanted to be around him, and he had this calm, understated personality. And then a lot of that calm went away when he got the football in his hands. But it's one thing that they spoke to Devin Hester about was just how far he came since, you know, entering the NFL as this very meek, mild, and quiet rookie with the Chicago Bears.
Yeah, it was a whirlwind for me, you know, just more so of the first 2 years, people didn't believe I could do what I do. And the following 4 or 5 years from now, people respected me. So they whenever I was out there on the field, they feared me. So it limited the returns that I had. So that played a big toll in my career, I would say, you know, just with the new rule nowadays, I probably would have had over 40 returns.
Yeah, it's hard to disagree when you think about it. And we got a chance to look at the new kickoff rules last night. And the way that the league has tried to, like the term that Richard Hightower has used a bunch in the media, Bears special teams coordinator, talking about keeping the foot in the game. And as safety has become this big focal point for rules adjustments in the NFL, safety of quarterbacks in the pocket, safety of receivers coming across the middle, safety of players on special teams running full speed, screaming down the field, dozens and dozens of yards and going 20 plus miles an hour and crashing into each other at these high velocities, then yes, your brain is going to be rattled in an enhanced way. Orthopedically, your joints are going to take more of the brunt of those impacts. And so they've made some adjustments, and they took advantage of the opportunity to talk to Devin Hester, especially after getting to watch it live and in person last night, on the new kickoff rules, because the foot, at least at the moment, it does appear is going to stay in the game.
I feel like the new rule is really going to force the return game, bring it back to life. And so it's a way to bring back special team. It's a way to bring back the returners that kind of got shadowed and overlooked because of the new rule. Of course, y'all know the rule was put in because of me. So
that's right.
Now it allows return to get their hands on the ball. So I'm hoping that we can bring back this return game, which was a big exciting part of the game.
And now I got to say, my initial impressions after watching it play out last night, I'm still not certain what to make of it. I don't know if teams will, you know, like the Bears having Velus Jones, having access to him, who has showed talents as a returner, both at the collegiate level and at the professional level, as a kick returner more so than a punt returner in both phases, but certainly in the NFL here. But what do the Bears do with a player like Velus Jones? Is that enough? I mean, we saw what Cordarrelle Patterson, the career that he's been able to put together without necessarily being a big or a consistent weapon offensively, certainly as a running back after moving from wide receiver. He's had some of his best seasons when folks just turn and hand him the ball or toss him the ball. There's been a role that's been found for Cordarrelle Patterson on offense during his career, but certainly being considered a great player, it's as a returner. He's been a great return specialist throughout his career and potentially of Hall of Fame caliber when you look at the numbers that he's been able to put together here. There's only going to be so many of those who have that opportunity. So I do wonder, what's that going to look like moving forward? What brand of player will be utilized there? You know, we saw the contract that DJ Moore just got from the Bears. Would they be willing to utilize a player like DJ Moore, who's a big-time wide receiver? But in this scenario now with the new rule, how will that end up being viewed, not only initially where everybody's just kind of waiting to see what plays out, but as you get through games of this season, as if the rule stays at least in some form or fashion of what it is right now, where the blockers and the cover people are only 5 yards apart, then do teams just start to treat this as a scrimmage play? Do they just start to treat this almost like an opportunity just between the white lines, or just a regular offensive snap? And if you do you get the opportunity to utilize running backs, receivers, players who are some of your best playmakers with the football in their hands? And in the past, this would have been viewed as putting your best players at risk if you run them out there as returners on special teams. But do you see some teams start to utilize some of these playmakers in that way? Does Derrick Henry, who was an amazing kick returner in high school because of his size and speed, does Derrick Henry return kicks in the NFL because this is like taking a toss play, you know, for a guy like Derrick Henry? I'm really curious what that ends up looking like. And so regardless of it, the Devin Hester archetype, we've very likely seen the last of that, because while the foot is staying in the game, the return game is still going to be a big part of how things operate moving forward. It's going to look very different. We got to look at that last night, as did Devin Hester. We'll continue the conversation about all these Hall of Famers and what's to come for them tomorrow. Also going to share some stories about what I ended up experiencing, because the Hall of Fame and the importance of it that players and fans end up placing on it. I want to talk through some of that with some of the conversations that I've had specifically with some of the guys who've been through this and have experienced what it's like. And especially because, you know, there have been some opportunities for me to cover these guys, not only interviewing them on the air, but to have some conversations with them off camera and what this has been like for them. We're going to address that and kind of get into that with you. And feel free to give me a call at 312-644-6767, 312-644-6767. Among some of the all-time greats who are on their way to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, three players who have represented the Chicago Bears very well amongst that crew. We're keeping that conversation rolling as we preview the Pro Football Hall of Fame enshrinement. We'll keep that going in that final hour coming up on The Score.